So I have this memory of the first time I ever was immersed in Spanish. And I was actually in Madrid. I was about to spend 1 month with this family, full immersion. And they picked me up on a Sunday at the airport and they drove me to their house. And it was the Sunday meal. So imagine 14 people around a table, all of them family members, speaking Spanish at the speed of lightning, and me having my basic high school Spanish course in my pocket and a tiny little dictionary, and sitting there at the table and trying to understand what people were saying and trying to even answer their questions. And so every time I would pick up a word that I didn't know, I'd open my little dictionary and try to find that word. But of course, by the time I found the word, they were 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sentences past me. So after an hour and a half of this nonsense, I just sat there, ate my meal, tried to figure out what was going on around me. Of course, I couldn't because the language was just going too fast and too many conversations simultaneously. And so it took me about 2 days of this treatment to finally say, you know what, I don't need this dictionary. I threw it in my suitcase. But what I did do is I found a little four-year-old girl named Aida, and she was the granddaughter of the man who I was staying with, and he still had two kids staying with him that were older than me. And I basically became Aida's babysitter, and I hung around her for the whole month, and I learned Spanish. And by the time I left, I could speak it fluently. And the reason why it worked is because a four-year-old doesn't speak half as fast as an adult and has about, you know, one-third of the vocabulary. So I would walk around the house with her and say, I had learned esto que es, what is this? So I would point at things and say, esto que es, and she would tell me mesa, that's a table, or luz, that's a light. And that's how I learned all my vocabulary with this little four-year-old. So that's what brought me into learning my third language.
That's a good story. Welcome to the Multipod, episode 4. Today we are exploring the fascinating topic of language. Studies show that learning a second language before puberty greatly increases chances of full mastery.
Learning two languages simultaneously as a young child has many more benefits than one can imagine. Dr. Brenda K. Gorman, who is a PhD in speech pathology and audiology, has conducted several studies which show that children who grow up in multilingual homes actually develop stronger linguistic and learning skills than monolingual children.
Some of you may have heard of Benny. He's the Irish polyglot. That's what he goes by. A polyglot is a person who knows or is able to use several languages. Benny has a popular blog and video series. He reckons you can be fluent in a new language in 3 months without traveling or being a genius to do it. A study at the University of Haifa, Israel, demonstrates that under the right conditions, adults are better language learners than children.
Dr. Edwin Gerard, who now works for the Lycée Français in Los Angeles, was raised in a home where four languages were spoken at all times. During his TED Talk on multilingual citizens, he says, "What you learn when you learn languages is not just vocabulary and grammar. You're also learning codes of communication."
The next quote is by Dr. Eric Lenneberg, a renowned linguist and neurologist who taught at Harvard Medical School. He said children have a superior ability to learn a foreign language. It's biological. There's a flexible stretch of time, a period of functional plasticity before the brain lateralizes language into a rigid compartment. Children who learn languages before 12 have no trouble learning a third, fourth, or fifth language later in life.
Many academics point towards the positive aspects of being a polyglot. However, many pediatricians and kindergarten-level professionals ask parents not to confuse their children by teaching them more than one language. They even go as far as asking foreign-speaking parents to speak only the local language, for example, English or French, to their children to help them integrate in their local school.
So we're setting up here that you can tell there's a lot of different perspectives and takes, academic and otherwise, on language and how to learn language and the various ages that we learn language. So we're really excited to explore this today, and in particular because it's quite a personal thing to both Sandrine and myself and our guest. You'll get a little bit more of our backstory in listening to this episode, learning a bit about who we are, and framed around the theme of language. Sandrine is trilingual, and let's start with what would you consider to be your first language, if there's one?
So, funny enough, my mother tongue is French, but I went to school in English from the age of 8. So the really neat aspect of it all is that whenever I, like even with my own child now, whenever I help him with his school studies, I am a really bad tutor for his French because I didn't study French at school. So I don't know the grammar rules and the why we say this way. I just know when it's right and when it's wrong, but I can't explain why. So he has to like do all these, you know, exercises in school where they talk about the objet, complément d'objet direct and all these terms. And I have a bit of a clue, but I'm not that good at it. Whereas in English, because I learned English at school and in an English environment, I lived in the States when I was 9 years old. And so I moved there full immersion again from 9 until I was 13. Then I moved to Toronto 13 to 18. So basically I spent almost 10 years in English environments learning in English schools. So I always say my first language is French, but I'm just as comfortable and feel just as if my English was also my first language, just because I master both at the same level.
So do you remember a time when you only really spoke French, when it was just that one language?
Yeah, I do, actually. It was pretty funny because I grew up in France, and if anybody knows France and French people, they're very, very proud of being French, and they're proud of their language, and they're really not very open to learning other languages, which is actually causing a bit of an issue for the economy of the country. So when I was a little girl, I used to sing English songs, right? Because, of course, in France, they're very pro-America and even more back then. And so we used to have a lot of, you know, Elton John and just a bunch of English singers. And Stevie Wonder was one of them. And I remember singing songs in English, but having no clue what the English lyrics were. So I would be like, when, and I would just say a bunch of stuff that meant nothing. And I remember when I was 9 or 10 and finally learning English and then singing those same songs and going, that's what they say. So it was a big revelation to find out what, you know, lyrics were really about and what the sentences meant.
That's a good memory. At some point you picked up Spanish as well, so you consider yourself trilingual now.
Yeah, so when I was 16, like I mentioned, I picked up Spanish living in Spain for a month, picked it up, went back to Toronto for 2 years, and then went back to Spain when I was 18 and perfected it there and lived a year and a half then in two different parts of Spain, Madrid and Barcelona. So actually now I really feel like I master all three, although in Spanish I have a little less of a mastery because sometimes my vocabulary is not as rich. But all in all, I feel like all three languages, I can switch from one to the other and back without having to think or translate. And since then I've learned Portuguese and Italian, but I'm not fluent in either of them. I'm able to carry a basic conversation, but I'm not fluent. I also learned Luxembourgish because I lived in Luxembourg for a while. And it's a language that's close to German, but it's actually closer to Dutch. And it's a mix of Dutch, German, and French, all basically blended into one. And it was weird because I was able to catch on to the Luxembourgish, but I was never able to catch on to the German.
Oh, yeah.
So very strange how the brain works. I'm looking forward to hearing how that works when we have our guest Sienna speak to us soon. But what about you, Ted?
Well, I grew up as your classic Canadian Anglophone in English Ontario, where you can take core French. Well, you can take French immersion. And English Canadians especially will know about this because as young children from like 5, 6 years old, your parents can choose to put you in a French immersion program, and most cities and schools have that option. For whatever reason, we didn't. For me, I started in grade 4, which I guess would be about maybe 9 or 10 years old. And at that point, you know, you're learning French about an hour, maybe an hour or two a week kind of thing. It's very, very basic. Now, I was always interested in French. I had no other real exposure to it, but something about French and Quebec as a French province was always interesting, fascinating to me. So I chose to keep studying French through school right up to what at the time was grade 13 in Ontario here. And, you know, I knew a little bit of vocabulary, but I certainly didn't consider myself functional by any means. I once did a summer exchange program in high school to a little village in Quebec, Thetford Mines. That was my first real exposure to being completely immersed in French. And I realized part of the thing, I think, which might still be the case, is a lot of English Canadians think that French Canadians, of course, French is their first language, but that most of them can probably get by and function a little bit in English. And until you go there, outside of Montreal and Quebec City to some extent, and there's other pockets of English, but, you know, if you go into the rural parts of the province or even some of the medium-sized cities, it's 99% Francophone. And that's you really see that it's a different it's a whole different culture, of course, and people function in French, and they only function in French. So that was my first kind of exposure to it. But, you know, it was, I realized that I had to make it a priority if I really wanted to become fluent and or at least be able to function in French. And eventually that came around as a long story. But when I met Emily, who became my wife, she and I were working out in the Canadian Rockies one summer in 2007. That's where we met, kind of a summer job. And she has a great story, too, in that she grew up completely Francophone. Her family barely speaks a word of English. She was always interested in English, and she chose to go to college and university in English, having gone to summer camp. So she threw herself right in at the age of like 17 in a completely immersed English environment. And by the time we met, I would consider her basically fluent. I didn't think anything of it. So we met, and you know, we got together. We lived out west a little bit, and we ended up traveling the world for a while. All this time, our relationship was in English. And I did spend a bit of time in Quebec, and I certainly have some memories of meeting her family and being, you know, completely thrown into that environment where there's dozens of people and everyone's speaking fast French in the Quebec accent, Quebec dialect. And this is nothing that I had learned in high school French. So now you realize what it's really like. Still, I wasn't prepared to live there and make that commitment. So eventually we did. And in the late 2012, Emily's a teacher. She teaches English, even though she's a Francophone. She teaches English to high school kids in Quebec. And so we moved to the city of Drummondville, which is between Montreal and Quebec City. And I finally committed to learning French. And that was thrown in 100% immersion. And we switched our relationship from English to French. And we stopped speaking English to each other. Like maybe, not even, I'd say one day a week, like maybe half a day on Sunday, we might set aside a bit of English time. But I went full in French immersion for the better part of really a couple years before I felt comfortable to, you know, switch back and forth. And now it's been a good 5 years or so since then. So then I definitely consider myself very functional in French. I would not consider myself fluent, and I hope we can talk about this. I'd like to know what you guys think about the definition of fluency. But, you know, I don't get hung up on that. I know I can function. I work in French. I spend lots of time with her family completely in French. I can easily be immersed for weeks on end and feel pretty comfortable. Not as at ease as I am in English, of course. I still miss some vocabulary and other expressions and things like that. But I understand 85, 90% of it easily. So it's been quite the journey. And it's still going. As I say, you know, it's absolute core to my existence now to have switched to a bilingual experience. And coming from that Anglophone Canadian background, where you really, once you move west of the province of Quebec and Ottawa, which is kind of on the border, anywhere west of that, I mean, you can find communities of Francophones in places like Toronto and Vancouver, but it's pretty hard to find much French and to get the exposure to it. And so most English Canadians don't, even if they want to learn French, they just don't have the opportunity. So it was a real experience to make that choice in my life, and I had someone to do it with, of course, to have the opportunity to learn as an adult, because all this started when I was 32 or so, 33. So that's the gist of my story.
Wow, really interesting story. Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Actually, I will ask you one more question with regards to that. What did you find was the toughest, like the biggest challenge of learning that, the full immersion aspect of learning French, being, you know, over the age of 15, 16 and like being a full blown adult?
Oh, for sure. It's the it's not wanting to make a mistake. It's the being self-conscious, which you would expect. And I see it now in our kids. And we may talk about this, too, because, you know, we have two young kids and we're raising them bilingual. And my daughter is two years old. She's switched back and forth. She doesn't think anything of it. She loves repeating sounds. And that's interesting to see. I was so afraid to do that. I was like, oh, I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to look like an idiot and all this stuff. And you have to let that go, of course, eventually. But that was the big challenge for the first few months, really. You don't want to look like a fool. So you have to get over that and just throw yourself in.
Yeah, indeed. I'm really excited about the person we have in our virtual studio here. We're happy to welcome Sienna, and I think I'm going to try not to massacre your last name, Wareszki. Is that close?
It originally was Wareszki back in Poland, but now we say Wareszki.
Wareszki, okay. You're an expert in linguistics who studied at York University in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And you're also multilingual. So welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and where you grew up and what you're doing now with your career, things like that?
Yeah, sure. Oh, my goodness. So I was born and raised in the Greater Toronto Area. It's in a little town a little bit north. It's not that little. A little north of Toronto itself called Richmond Hill. And I was born to a father who was also born and raised in Toronto and spoke English and speaks English, just is Anglophone, and a mother who grew up trilingual. So my mom's parents were both basically war refugees from the World War back in the day. They both came from what was formerly known as Yugoslavia. One was from Belgrade, one was from Montenegro, and so they both spoke Serbian. And they taught their children, and they lived in their house in Serbian. That was the mother tongue, if you will. But they also lived in Gatineau and in Montreal. Like, these are the places that they wound up settling. And so my mother had Serbian at home, French in the quartier, in the neighborhood, and then English at school because they happened to be in an English neighborhood in Montreal at the time. So she grew up, you know, trilingual. And so she taught that to me and my sister. So I grew up English and French. Not so much the Serbian. That was kind of a thing that you heard off the grandparents and off of the aunties and things. And then I also went to French immersion because living in Toronto, as you said, there are communities. They exist. But unless you happen to have found your way into one early, it can be pretty difficult to maintain a language outside of a place that just speaks it, you know, every day in the street and in shops and things. So I went into French immersion for 3 years and was doing basically French in school, English at home for a while. And then I switched schools in fourth grade, so it was about 9-10, and that was into an English language school. So then I did French as a second language. So I had kind of both of the scholastic experiences of language teaching in Canada. And then I went to a bilingual university. So York University is not technically bilingual, but it has a campus called Glendon. And Glendon campus is known for being the bilingual campus of York University. Everyone who goes there graduates with a bilingual degree in English and French. Whether you come in, you know, parfaitement bilingue déjà, whether you're already perfectly bilingual, or whether you only know a little bit of one or the other, there are all kinds of different options that give you the language sort of training and the language experience that you need to get out of there in 4 or 5, however many years, able to speak both and to talk about your major in both, which is great. So that's a bit about my language background. So I know English and French. I took a year of Spanish at Glendon. So I understand some Spanish. I took a year of Japanese in high school. So I know some basic Japanese, which is a lot of fun when I went to Japan. And I've taken 2 years of Ojibwe, which is a Native Canadian language, Anishinaabemowin, which I think is really interesting. And then, you know, someday I'll go and talk to my grandparents about learning Serbian. So I'm a little bit all over the map. But being a linguist tends to do that.
So that's right. You studied linguistics as your major.
Mm-hmm. That's the one. So you get the bilingual university studying languages. So it's like a perfect environment. It's like a little fish tank. You can watch everything happening. So you get your classes where you're learning about morphology, phonology, stuff like that. I'll get into a little bit what linguistics actually means in a second. And then you go out of class and you know, walk into the cafeteria and you see what you were just learning in action, which I thought was really cool. Because sometimes it doesn't happen, depending on your major. If you're a bio major and you've been, you know, learning about, who knows, like parasitology for a second, you're not going to walk out into the hall and be like, ah, yes, I see that. It doesn't happen the same way.
Studying languages, as you went into the study of it, already bilingual at least, did it change your point of view on multilingualism, being multilingual?
I think it did. I think a lot of people who go in monolingual have this massive fear of messing it up. I mean, even as you said, you had this as learning as an adult, you were so worried about making a fool of yourself or being perceived maybe as not being as intelligent or as knowledgeable or funny or whatever as you actually are in your own head, because you just don't have the means of expressing or communicating what's going on in here. But coming in already bilingual made it, especially bilingual in the languages of the university, made it so that I had that initial hurdle kind of out of the way. And then on top of that, we have conversations at that university every single day about what it means to be fluent. And everyone has a different answer, right? So you could conceive of fluency as being perfectly, you know, you can write a novel in both languages kind of thing, or all three. Maybe that's your idea of fluency. Or you could think of fluency the way Benny, the Irish polyglot, does, which is able to carry out a conversation, like able to meet people and have some interesting conversations, even if you mess up your grammar, even if you mess up that expression, like it's fine, as long as everyone's having a good time and you're getting through with what you're saying. And then there's everything in between there. There's also kinds of fluency or bilingualism that have to do with different areas of the brain. So if you are one of those people who says, you know, in Spanish, you always get the comprendo más que puedo hablar, like I understand, you know, like entiendo más, like I get more. If you talk to me, I understand, but I can't speak back. Like I can't produce language. That's a kind of bilingualism, to be able to understand or maybe to be able to read. If you did a lot of language learning in school, they teach a lot of reading without a lot of speaking, but you can't produce it through your mouth. That's a kind of bilingualism, and it's identified as different from being able to carry out a conversation orally or maybe through signs. So having those experiences and then coming in and learning there's even more to bilingualism than you already know from your life experience was super cool.
Was there an anecdote or a joke or something that you could tell us that happened to you while you're learning another language?
There is something funny about Japanese that is true as far as the friends that I have mentioned this to me. I don't know if it's true for all of the Japanese people, but I know that for the ones I talk to, this is true. You don't say no in Japanese because it's just culturally not a thing that they want to do because they don't want to impose or be impolite or be recalcitrant or cause conflict. So instead, and they also don't like to be like, you're wrong. Like if someone says something and you think that it's stupid, you don't go, that's stupid. You say, so desu ka? And what so desu ka literally means is that so? And so it's kind of culturally understood to be like the nice, polite, like, ah, I see. And you kind of smile and nod your head and move on. And so every now and again with my friends, if someone says something that's a little bit, you know, a little gauche or a little, you know, something that you're not totally in agreement with, sometimes I'll look and go, ah, so this guy. This is sometimes something that people don't get because they don't happen to have taken Japanese. And so there's also that thing, I'm sure, I don't know if either of you have done this before, I'm guessing you have, where you use a language that maybe the group you're talking to hasn't learned and doesn't get them, then you have to explain yourself. Like, does that happen to other people or is it just me?
I know that there's those inside jokes. I guess they'd be the same as an inside joke, you know, where you would say something to somebody even in the same language and the person in front of you kind of looks at you and says, what are you talking about? You go, oh, forget it. It's just an inside. And I think, yeah, inside jokes can be multilingual as well. I don't have any recollection right now, but I know I did, something happened to me when I was in Spain is somebody played a joke on me that lasted 6 months where they told me how to say something. And I was saying it wrong just as a joke. And they did it on purpose to say, yeah, this is how you say it. And it took me 6 months for somebody to actually come up and say, you know, you're saying that wrong. And somebody had taught me that. Like, so I had trusted, you know, the locals, right? And it wasn't a bad word or anything. It was just a really wrong way of a wrong grammar. Like, it was a bad grammar mistake. And I was saying it was about how to say, I know something. Well, I was conjugating no at the wrong tense, even though I knew how to say I don't know in the right tense, but I hadn't made the connection in my head. So I would say I know in the wrong tense, but I don't know in the right tense. And so somebody one day came up to me and said, you know, that's not how you say I know. And I'm like, really? But I've been saying that for 6 months. Yeah, well, somebody, well, how did, why? Well, somebody convinced me that I know was a different tense than I don't know. So that was a bad insight that really followed me for quite some time. It's weird how, you know, when you don't know, right? When you don't know another language and you trust the locals, well, the locals
sometimes they
can
play
do
tricks.
Oh yeah, they can do whatever they want with you.
That's the thing, and you can, I mean, it's a learning experience. You get a thick skin, basically, and you can apply that experience to other things that you kind of shrug things off maybe more once you become multilingual, and especially learning it as an adult, and you get used to just letting stuff go. You know, where you can't let things, you're so used to not letting things bother you because you can't get hung up on silly little mistakes and so on, that you can apply that maybe to other things in life. You kind of feel your brain expanding a bit, you know, that you're tapping into those other corners of the brain as you learn another language. And as I say, you could apply that to learning all sorts of other new skills.
Absolutely.
And actually, it brings the thought of, when you learned Japanese and then you went to Japan, Sienna, how long did you go for?
Oh my goodness, this is a great story. So I was 19 when I went to Japan for a week. And I went for it was actually a business trip. I went with a research group to go and present at a linguistics conference in Oita in Japan. But we were not staying in Oita. And in fact, we were not staying in, you know, any of the big cities like Tokyo, Osaka. Like, no. We were staying in a tiny spot on the earth in southern Japan. And the thing about Bungo Takara is nobody speaks English. And the thing about the research team is nobody spoke Japanese. Except for me. Barely, like squishy, tiny, tiny bit, like enough to get by. So I'm sitting there. I'm 19 years old. I've never traveled this far on my own in my life. And I have to like coordinate getting to the hotel and making sure everyone has enough to eat and getting directions to places. And for some reason, our prof took a different plane from the rest of us. And so we have to find him. And it was just all over the place. But it was a great experience because you do. You eventually just have to let things go and be like, you know, I can't get frustrated at not being able to express myself as I would like. I'm going to have to just use a lot of hand gestures and maybe write things down and be very grateful for your patience and your generosity. And that's something I will say is the people of Bunga Takara were so generous and so kind and so patient with us that really it didn't matter that we were totally out of our depth. We had a great time anyway, and we still made friends. So it was a great experience. And yeah, you definitely learn to just kind of shrug it off and keep trying and have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the great attitude. That's the best attitude to have, because if you get frustrated, you'll be frustrated a long time. And a week yeah. And a week can seem like 6 months if you're frustrated. Ted, when you did your full immersion in Quebec and you're now in this Francophone environment and constantly speaking French, how are you adjusting to not hearing a single word of your own language? Even though you weren't in a different country, you're still in a different place that felt like probably a different country.
Yeah, it's true. It did. And I learned to appreciate that a lot more. But I probably cheated a little bit by listening to YouTube and things like that to hear a bit of English, but it's not really the interaction. And I wasn't trying to cheat. It's just that I didn't feel completely cut off. But regardless, I wasn't conversing with anybody in English. And I do remember over the course of those good couple years I lived in Drummondville, aside from occasionally when Emily and I would speak English, the only conversations I'd have would be on the phone with my family, maybe once a week, you know, every couple of weeks kind of thing. So, yeah, I know I was fortunate in having someone to share the experience with, obviously my partner and her family, who were very supportive, very welcoming. So I never felt alone, but it changes your personality. I like to talk about this and the different personalities we have in other languages. And I feel like a different person in French. Maybe that would evolve over time as I become what I would consider to be more fluent and more comfortable and kind of merge my English personality with French. But the way I'm talking right now, I rarely talk that way in French unless I really know what I'm saying. Because otherwise I'm still searching for words, or I say the words that I know. And I know a lot of words, but not as much as in English. And so I behaved differently in French, and I became used to that personality. I felt like a stranger in myself at the beginning. And now that's kind of another personality, as I say, over the course of 5 years, and it's kind of evolved into a thing. I feel comfortable in that, but I feel like a different person a lot of the time. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. So we should talk about that, about how people project themselves in those other languages.
Let's bring it over to you, Sienna, with the academic in you. What can you tell us about that whole aspect of, you know, maybe how the brain works, how we function, and how it can, why do we feel that we change personalities? Because I share that same feeling.
It's because we do. It's neurolinguistic, psycholinguistic backup that basically says, yeah, you develop a different personality depending on what language you're using. And the reason why is actually pretty intuitive. It's because language is culture. And culture is language. And if you're really immersing yourself in a language, you're also immersing yourself in a different culture, a different sense of humor, a different worldview. And you are your worldview. So you don't think about it because, you know, when you're learning a language, maybe because you're just thinking about trying to translate what you would say as the speaker of whatever you're already speaking. But eventually you get that, you know, like trying to translate one expression into the other, and you go, there just is no one-to-one correlation. There's nothing that does that. Maybe because they just don't use those words to express that concept. Maybe because that concept doesn't exist. There is an indigenous language in Canada that has no word for I'm sorry. There's no word for that. There's no word to say I'm sorry. But they have a phrase that they use in the equivalent context, and that translates to I'll make this right.
Mm.
And it's a very different, you can already kind of imagine what culture would birth that different response, right? There is, pretty sure in ancient Egyptian, there wasn't actually a word for death the way that we conceptualize it. The word roughly translated meant westing, as in the way the sun sets in the west. and then comes back up again in the East. Like this, that whole, you know, kind of reincarnation or afterlife thing going on. So they just, the very foundational concepts of being human change culture to culture. And that gets expressed through the language of those people. So when you learn a new language, you're learning a new mode of being a person. So of course you change.
Yeah, very interesting indeed.
It's cool.
It's so funny. When you said that whole thing about the whole culture and how in some languages some things don't exist, I was just, as I was doing research for this episode, I came across that man who talked about the codes of languages, Edwin Gerard. And he was also talking about the fact that, and that's, it was so funny. I laughed so much when I saw that part of the talk. He was talking about how in France, you're either perfectly fine, a little bit tired, or dead. Like you're not really, you don't talk about your ailments. It's true. In France, it's not a good thing. Like nobody wants to know what your problems are in your body. They don't care. And it's not elegant to talk about it. So you always say, I'm un peu fatigué. I'm un peu stressé. You're always a little bit, you'll never ever have somebody tell you, you know, I'm so tired. I'm exhausted. I didn't sleep last night. They won't go into those depths. It's like, it's none of your business. They'll just stick to the what's okay to show as a facade, you know? So it's interesting how
in Quebec, though, I think people are much more upfront about it, because like you'd hear je suis un peu fatigué, but I often hear and say je suis bien fatigué, je suis tellement fatigué, like really, really tired, as an example. Same language, basically, but different dialect and different culture.
Mm-hmm. Totally, totally different culture, really different things. And that's me having grown up part of my life in France and then coming to Quebec. I literally, and that's another really interesting and funny little thing, is that when I got here, I already spoke three languages. So I thought, meh, the Quebec French, no problem. For 3 weeks, I couldn't understand anyone. But I felt like the stupidest person on earth. I thought to myself, what is wrong with you? You can speak three languages, but you can't understand your own language with a different accent. What is wrong? But it wasn't the accent. It was the accent, the speed, the expressions, the sentence structure had changed. I mean, everything had changed. And so I felt like I was being so rude because I was asking people to repeat constantly. And so sometimes I would just smile and laugh at whatever they said and thinking, I can't make them repeat again. And then they would look at me and go, well, you didn't answer my question. Oh, that was a question. So I felt even dumber.
It reminds me of the time when we were coming back from our trip around the world. We arrived in Paris as our last stop, and after that we were coming back to Canada. And so this is before I'd started any of my immersion in French, and I was going with like your basic core French. And we went to a cafe in Paris, and I ordered something, and the waiter understood me in my broken French more than they understood Emily, fluent Québécoise. She still reminds me of that.
Yeah, and it's actually a lot of French people, when they see Quebecers, they'll switch to English if they know English, because they find it's easier to talk in English with a Quebecer than it is to talk French, just because of the difference. And it's true, the accent is not easy to catch on to. And I have to say, it took me a while, but now I can even speak with the accent.
That's what's brilliant, too. I mean, you know, you think about how many different accents or dialects or versions, you know, whatever you want to call them, of a language there are, especially world languages, what we call world languages. You think, you know, English, French, Spanish, you know, maybe in other places you get Dutch. So that kind of stuff. Like, and at my school, again, there were people from all over the world. We had people from over 100 different countries, 100 different francophone countries. So you had your Quebecois French, sure, but you also had your French from Northern Ontario. You had your French from Nova Scotia. You had your French from France, from North and South France and the weird middle bit. You had people from Cote d'Ivoire. You had people from Haiti. You had people from the Congo, all over the place. And so you learned really fast that one French doesn't mean you know all the French.
Absolutely.
And then you learn over time to distinguish them. So, you know, after being there for 5 years, I can, for the, you know, I might need to still ask, you know, répétez s'il vous plaît une fois encore, but you can eventually get over the rhythms of the different ones and kind of find the core, that the common core under all of them, which is really cool. And it's cool, again, to see how the worldview, especially with the language, we'll call them a colonial language, like French or like English, how the different versions change when they've had to be adopted and then adapted by a culture that had it forced upon them. So you have have like, you know, Congolese French, which is entirely different from Quebecois or from Le Bon Français over in France. And part of that is because different people, and part of it is because they've taken it and they've tried to, you know, reclaim it and make it part of their worldview and part of the way that they express themselves. And so that also comes into it. You get these weird hybrid things going on thanks to the spread of colonial languages and what people have done with them in the decades and the centuries after.
Indeed. And I see it a lot when I speak Spanish with people. If I speak with Spanish with people from Mexico or from El Salvador or from Argentina or from, because in Quebec, we actually do have quite a big South American population here. I mean, it's not bigger than the French from France population, but it's still quite a big community. And depending on where they're from, of course, every time I say five words, they're like, oh, you're from Spain, because they hear the accent. And me too, I've gotten to a point where now I can listen and I know, oh, that's from Argentina or that's from Mexico, because now there are some real very defined differences between each one. But even in English, in North America, even, I mean, the accent from Toronto, the accent from Alberta, the accent from BC, the accent, and then in the States, of course, we all know the Texas and the Virginia and the Indiana is pretty peculiar. And so all these places have different accents. And sometimes you listen to somebody speak, you know, or have a conversation face to face, and you're literally, I'm reading lips, because if I don't read their lips, I cannot understand what they're saying. So very interesting how even speaking the same language feels like there's just 10 different languages in that same language because of the colonial aspect of it all. I'm really curious about how the brain works with compartmenting, if it does or if it doesn't. I don't know if you have anything to share on that.
I'll take two things. I can take one that's more of a science-y brain thing, and then one that's more of like a practical, you know, motivational takeaway. So the first has to do with the way that the brain encodes language. And this is something that will hearten all of the people out there who think, oh, I can understand when someone speaks this language, but I can't speak back. Or I can read really well, but I can't speak. Or I can speak, but I can't read. Or my writing is just awful. Like, you know, all of these bits. There's actually four different areas in the brain that take those different pieces and encode them and file them away. So you have your writing and your reading, and they kind of come together under an umbrella, but there's two different, there's input and output. And then you have your speaking and your listening. These are all dealt with different, you know, audio processing, visual processing, different parts of the brain. And so they develop at different rates. They don't all come as one. So unless you're getting a really holistic, immersive language environment where you are doing all four of these things, you're speaking, you're listening, you're reading, and you're writing, they're not all going to develop at the same rate. So if per se you had an education in, you know, when I took FSL courses in the Canadian language education system, it was a lot of writing. It was very writing focused. Luckily, we're kind of moving away from that now. But when I was in grade school, it was very much learn to read and write and learn your vocabulary and learn your conjugations. And we're not going to talk to each other. And what that meant, you as well? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how they did it for a couple of decades before they realized this isn't working. But you get a lot of people who come into high school or come into, you know, the real world or wherever they're going, who can read French really well and can also write, you know, they can write a journal entry, they can write a short personal essay, whatever. But if you talk to them, even at like a nice slow pace, they have no idea what you're saying or how to respond, because it's two completely different areas of the brain that are encoding these things. So if anyone out there struggles with, oh, you know, I'm not as good as I should be because I've been studying, you know, I don't know, Portuguese for 7 years, but I still can't hold a basic conversation, maybe you just need to study differently. Because the brain does take these things and compartmentalize them. So that's really cool stuff. And the other thing that I have to share is the golden rule, the first thing that you learn in linguistics training, and they beat it into you for years in different contexts, is this thing, this endless war in the linguistics world, and it's the war between prescriptivism and descriptivism. So prescriptivism essentially is the mandate that we as linguists should be telling people how to speak or how to use a language. You know, it's a lot of rule making. It's where the kind of the grammar Nazi comes from, that archetype of someone who goes, well, this is how it's supposed to be. You get l'Académie Française, who is basically the, you know, the stereotype of a prescriptivist association, where you get, this is how it's supposed to be. And if you change it, or if you say something, or if you use y'all, you're wrong. And this is how you should be doing it. You can't end a sentence with a preposition. You can't do this way. You can't split an infinitive, like all those rules that you might've heard growing up in your, you know, high school English class. And then you have the descriptivists, who hold that the job of a linguist or any language user is just to observe how language is being used and then to document that. Because language is a living, breathing creature and it evolves and changes all the time. And if we were straight up prescriptivist and said, nope, it's done, you can't change it anymore, we'd all still be speaking old English.
So which one do you tend to follow more or subscribe yourself to?
Absolutely a descriptivist, and I think that all the prescriptivists need a sharp thwack up the back of the head and maybe an intro lesson in this stuff. Because that's the thing, you know, if we have languages that are never going to change again, they're called dead languages. And there's very few examples of a language that's been fossilized and, you know, you can't change this anymore that is still in current use. Because if something is in use, it's going to change according to the needs of the users. And the needs change over time. Because, again, you get back to language is culture. Culture is language. Culture is going to change. The people are going to change. So the language is going to change. I have great stories that I wish we had time for about things like the use of y'all and the second person plural pronoun. I get really uppity about this. Or if you want to get into social justice and stuff, the use of they and them as a gender neutral pronoun. People can get super uppity. They can't, you can't do that. It's for plural only. Well, no, we've been doing it for 1,000 years. You just need to go back into the history of the English language and find it. But it shouldn't matter anyway, because people are using it now, and it works. And that's the descriptivist view.
So even yourself as a descriptivist, do you see any kind of role for the prescriptivists?
I think the way that the world is now doesn't really allow for a prescriptivist worldview to be dominant, because of the fact that we are so globalized now. All different kinds of people are in contact with each other and learning from each other. So you get all kinds of borrowed words, borrowed phrases, borrowed ideas, which are going to change the language that you use. Even you have people like all of us who decide to learn other languages. Sometimes learning those languages modify how we use the ones we knew before. Maybe there's a phrase in a different language that perfectly describes this thing that you feel. So you just adopt it into your English usage. And every time someone goes, "Ooh, what does that mean?" then you can explain it to them. And maybe that changes. We have so many of those in English. Half of English is French. I'm going to be straight. Half of English is French from 1066 AD when William the Conqueror rocked up to Normandy and, you know, changed everything in Old English. And so it's been like this for thousands and thousands of years. And the prescriptivists kind of want it to stop doing that and want to just keep everything in a nice little tidy box. But that doesn't work when you have so many people exchanging ideas. So really, I think if there was ever a place for it, it's certainly not here and not now. Because now, as language lovers and language learners and language users, what we really need to do is kind of, again, let it go a little bit and let it have space to breathe and space to change and run. Because that's how language evolves and becomes better and more well-suited to the challenges and the, you know, joys of today.
I think that's a good note to end it on. It's an inspiring note, as to any of our audience, of course, who can sympathize and resonate with our experiences and or is thinking of learning other languages as well. We hope we've given you a bit of interesting perspective with our conversation today, and not just with our own stories, but some of the science and the brain functionality behind learning languages. And we're really excited to talk about this here today. Maybe we'll find some other nuances and other angles we can keep exploring language in other episodes as well. It's been a real delight, Sienna, having you on the show here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we hope we can talk to you with you again.
And for those of you, well, if you're interested in mingling and connecting with other polyglots or other language enthusiasts, you'll be happy to know that actually there are some language festivals out there I didn't even know existed. But the next one is actually in Montreal. It's called Langfest. It's taking place August 21st to 26th, 2018. It'll be at Concordia University. There are other language festivals in New York City. The next date hasn't come out yet, but every year they have them and they change cities every single year in Europe. So they've been in Berlin, in Thessaloniki, in Reykjavik, in Bratislava. So just Google language festival in the city that you live in, and you might actually have a nice surprise and discover there's a festival happening close to you where you can mingle with a bunch of people speaking lots of different languages.
Nothing is more useful than immersion. Throw yourself in. Don't hesitate, even whether it's for an hour, a day, whatever your situation is. And I can attest that it makes all the difference. If you have the opportunity, go for it. So we'll say merci beaucoup, gracias.
Obrigado.
Arigato gozaimashita. Hi. Shimiguech. Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome to Sandrine's Tip. This week, in line with our subject, I have chosen the top 5 ways to learn a new language. I've ranked them by success rate first and ease of implementation second. So let's start with number 5. Self-teaching with online courses. Look for the courses that provide audio and video recordings of the sentences you are learning, as well as live support. It's important to be able to read lips and hear the desired pronunciation and understand visually what the words look like in the written form. Rosetta Stone and Duolingo are the best out there. Number 4. Full immersion in the country you're interested in. The key here is to go alone. If you travel with your partner, friend, or colleague, it'll take much longer for the transition to take place as you will revert to the easy way out, that is, speaking in the language you're comfortable with. Go work or live with people who do not speak the language or languages you already know. Set a goal for yourself before leaving, to be fluent or to be able to carry on a conversation by the time you come home. Number 3. Taking weekly language courses in schools that emphasize on communication rather than solely writing and reading exercises. Look for the schools near you to determine the best one. Remember, the key here is to learn to communicate. You're not trying to write a novel in this new language. Number 2. Benny's Fluent in 3 Months program. If you're looking to possess conversational skills in any of the 22 languages his team can teach you, then yeah, by all means, give it your best shot. I mean, Benny the Irish polyglot has actually designed a system that makes learning fun and highly intuitive. I'm now tempted to finally learn Russian, or is it Mandarin? Or what about my Portuguese? Oh, so many to choose from. Anyhow, back to the list. Number 1, socializing with people who speak the language you are trying to learn. Our entire world has become multicultural. In most cities and even smaller towns, it's relatively easy to find people from a variety of countries who speak a bunch of different languages. But if you live on a tiny island in the middle of nowhere and you can't find those communities, then all you have to do is access the web and then you can look for those communities there. Use Skype or Google Hangouts and start communicating. You can decide to help your new friend learn English for 30 minutes and they can help you for the following 30 minutes. It's a win-win, easy, and totally free solution. Regardless of the one that you choose, whatever you decide to take as your way to learn a new language, just have fun with it. Enjoy making mistakes and sounding silly. As you heard, it makes for great anecdotes. So until next time, à la prochaine, auf Wiedersehen, ciao, hasta luego, matane, bye for now.
All right. Merci beaucoup, Sandrine. Well, let's take a quick look at who is in the Putty Tribe spotlight for the past couple weeks, those members who have made a contribution or who have stood out within the community and gained some recognition for doing so. The first being our new old friend, Robert Dempsey, who was on the show just a couple weeks ago as we talked about career versus job, vocational paths. And for Robert, it's been a change to getting into his coaching business, something that's fairly new for him, just the past few months or even weeks. And so as he mentioned on the show there, he's offering his reciprocal coaching service for those who want to talk about virtually anything, and it gains him some of the skills and practice in return. And it's because of things like that. Robert joined just a few weeks ago, and he really jumped right into the community. You see him a lot on the forum. He's organizing events and really getting himself involved, making the most of being part of the community. So we love to see that. It sets a great example and a big reason why he's been highlighted, especially so quickly. And like all of us, he's got lots of diverse interests. I see machine learning, public speaking, running conferences, neuroscience. He comes from that tech background, so of course he's interested in programming, things like WordPress, and expanding his interests in that field. So as always, say hello, check out his profile, and congratulations being in the spotlight of the week, Rob. And then we have Chaim Adler, another new member, just joining in early January of this year, 2018. Chaim's into bass guitar, Judaism, Jim Rohn's work, and helping out in many ways around the tribe. Some people, of course, get right in with lots of forum discussions, and others maybe help more on an individual level, perhaps behind the scenes. The group is always open to whoever wants to get involved in any kind of way. So that's Chaim's thing, as being another new member or just joining in. And we like to highlight those people that aren't necessarily the most present, the most obvious, but perhaps a little more behind the scenes as well, who certainly deserve the recognition just as much as anybody. Chaim lives in Israel and talks a lot about personal development insights, goals versus systems, setting up a plan and executing it successfully, something we can certainly all relate to. So great to see, as I say, another new member in the Potty Tribe Spotlight and getting themselves right in there involved with the community. Well, that was a fun episode. I think we really enjoyed exploring that topic, getting into some of our personal stories and hearing the perspective of Sienna, of course, as well. So I'm really glad that we did that. What do you think, Sandrine?
Well, I really enjoyed the fact that she had chosen languages that were so different. I mean, going from English, French, Spanish, to then Japanese and Ojibwe, that's just a real nice spread there. And very interesting to hear from somebody who's gone there.
So we like to keep exploring this topic of language. It's such a broad one, and hopefully we can come up with some other interesting angles and topics of discussion and come back to it again in a future episode. For our next episode of the Multipod, we are looking at the topic of minimalism, which is a fairly broad thing, but can encapsulate all sorts of ideas from lifestyle to things like tiny houses and, you know, minimal possessions, finances, all sorts of interesting areas. And it's a popular topic in our group, the Putty Tribe, so we'll see who we can get on the show and start exploring the topic of minimalism in the next episode.
Yes, and we will see that they can apply to many different things and sometimes even spark a joy or stress, depending on how we look at it.
Hopefully more joy.
Yes. Until then, we wish you a great 2 weeks and looking forward to being with you again then.
Thanks for listening, everybody.